But they're still just sitting there. Keep an eye out, Moya told her, then turned back to Persephone. Drumming her fingernails on the cup, she asked, So, what were you doing out in the forest? You never did say. Persephone looked embarrassed. You weren't really secretly meeting Wraith, were you? Moya sat up, her brows rising. You weren't, you know, what the stump said? No! Moya frowned and settled back in disappointment. What then? Persephone sighed. I went to talk to a tree. Moya, Roan, Bryn, and Padera looked at one another. Come again, Moya said. Persephone nodded toward the mystic, who sat cross-legged on the floor between a stack of flat stones and a battered basket stuffed with dusty pine cones. With Mina's head on her lap, Suri appeared oblivious to everything around her, playing intently with her string again, a spider-like pattern forming between her fingers. Suri came to me a while ago, saying she saw signs of a terrible catastrophe, something worse than any famine. I didn't think much of it at the time. But then the fray burned Dorea and Nadak, Moya said. Persephone nodded. Suri told me the old tree could help, would answer questions, and is the oldest tree in the forest. And she is, too, huge and ancient. How's Magda doing, anyway? Padera asked. The old woman was fanning the fire beneath the water sack. You know about the oak? Persephone asked. The old woman nodded. Melvin and I, we first... We were married under her leaves. Beautiful spring day. Songbirds filled her branches and sang to us. A good sign. Probably a sapling back then, eh, Padera? Moya grinned. Hard to tell, the old woman replied. Son hadn't been born yet. They all laughed, except for Roan, who paused in her plucking to study the old woman with new interest. Wraith and Malcolm returned, carrying an array of gourd jugs hanging from a pole. Into the large skin, over there, Padera pointed. So you actually spoke to this tree? Moya asked. I asked questions, Persephone clarified. Suri told me what the oak said. Roan, who was making a little pile of wet feathers at her feet, stopped plucking. She stared at Suri. You understand the language of trees? Suri nodded, without looking up from the web between her fingers, tongue sticking out as she worked the string thoughtfully. And what did it say? Moya asked. A bunch of gibberish, really, Persephone replied. Not gibberish. Suri spoke for the first time. You asked Magda for answers. She gave them. Problem solved. But none of it made any sense, Persephone said. Suri shrugged. Not Magda's fault you can't understand. She kept it simple for you, and she was right. But she always is. She was right? Persephone asked, confused. Suri nodded. What exactly did she say? Padera asked. Persephone shrugged. Something about... She looked at the mystic. Suri, do you remember? Welcome the gods, heal the injured, follow the wolf, Suri recited, without looking up. Can't get much simpler than that. Persephone spilled some of her tea. That's right! For the love of Mira, welcome the gods! Everyone looked toward the roundhouse's open doorway, where the evening sun cast a patch of light across Roan's floor mat. For Persephone, the light looked a little more golden, a little more magical than it had a moment before. I just got a chill, Moya said. Padera looked at her. More clothes might help. Oh, wait, I forgot who I was talking to. How about we try this instead? Less jawing and more work will warm you up. Get off that swing and cut up a bowl full of potatoes and set them in the sack to boil.
Then the old woman turned to Suri.
You staying for the meal?
I invited her, Persephone said.
That's fine, but it's going to take a while, Padera explained. Any chance you could help Persephone discover why Sackett, Adler and Hegner tried to kill her yesterday?
Persephone looked at Suri. Can you do that?
I'd need bones,
the mystic said.
Got a dead chicken right here.
Padera pointed at the bird Roan held.
Or do you need to kill it in some ritual?
Bird died today.
Wrung its neck an hour ago.
Should be fine.
The mystic pulled a loop around with two fingers and grinned to herself. Wraith finished dumping the water, set the gourds down near the door, then turned and surveyed the interior, looking for a place to sit. You're certain it's all right, us staying here tonight? Wraith asked. Might be a bit cramped.
We'll make room, Persephone said, then put a hand to her forehead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Roan. Roan, who was still only halfway done with the chicken, paused.
What for?
For being rude. This is your place, not mine. I shouldn't have spoken on your behalf. Roan tilted her head, then looked to Moya.
Forget it, Seth, Moya said, shaking her head with a sympathetic frown.
I'm still trying to convince her it's okay to sleep in the bed. Every night she curls up on the floor mat.
The floor mat?
Persephone looked over at a thin sheet of reeds that, being daytime, was rolled up and out of the way.
Why?
Moya looked to Roan. Roan rolled her shoulders.
It's Ivor's bed.
Ivor's dead, Persephone said. You understand that, right? It's your bed now. Roan offered only an embarrassed grimace.
See?
Moya sighed in resignation. Roan let the half-plucked chicken droop so that the bird's neck brushed the ground.
I've always slept on the floor.
But you own this place now. Everything, including the bed, is yours, Persephone said. You could at least sleep in one of these hanging chairs. These are very comfortable, by the way. Roan stared at her, breathing faster, her eyes tense, her hands wringing the chicken's legs.
Relax, Padera told her. Calm down and give me that bird before you ruin it.
Padera took the chicken back from Roan. The old woman finished plucking the second half of the bird in a pair of minutes. Once stripped, she chopped off both feet and pulled the crop and gizzard out of its severed neck.
Roan, the old woman said, go to my house and bring back a bag to collect these feathers. You can save them and make a nice pillow. You'll find a couple in the back next to dear old Melvin's clothes box.
Roan nodded once more with fierce conviction, the welling panic forgotten in light of the new task. She headed for the door, but halted abruptly before stepping out.
Whoa!
They all looked over and saw that Roan had nearly run into the giant who had arrived with the fray. He was standing in front of the roundhouse, blocking the entrance as he bent down and peered in. Persephone scrambled to her feet, and Wraith moved to her side. The giant didn't say a word, didn't look at the rest of them. His eyes were fixed on Padera, who was working at removing the chicken's viscera. The old woman peered up through her left eye, a hefty scowl on her collapsed mouth.
You're blocking my light.
The giant glanced down at his shadow and shuffled over a step.
It's easier for you.
The giant's voice surprised Persephone. She expected a loud, booming roar, but his words were soft.
Your hands are small. There aren't birds big enough for me to clean that way.
Again, Padera looked up, this time focusing on the giant's hands.
You need a hook.
She glanced toward Roan.
My Melvin's hands were too big for delicate work, too. Roan can make one that even your paws could manage. Can't you, Roan?
Roan, who'd been looking at the giant with as much wonder as the rest, narrowed her eyes and furrowed her brow. She wound a lock of hair, put the strands in her mouth, and chewed. Then she shocked everyone by walking up to the towering brute and grabbing hold of his right hand. Tilting up to catch the sunlight coming in through the door, she studied it and placed her own hand against his palm. The difference was striking. Roan's looked like a doll's. The giant said nothing. Roan muttered to herself, nodded, and then scurried to the back of her house, where Ivor's workbench was buried beneath a pile of assorted sediment. The giant watched her for a second, and then turned his attention back to Badera and the chicken.
"Stuffing?"
he asked, struggling to see. Badera nodded and raised the chicken up in the air.
"Filling her with bread and thyme."
"Garlic?"
"Of course."
"Butter?"
Badera scowled.
"Okay, stupid question. I don't always have access to any. What about pepper?"
Badera did her one-eyed glare, this time sucking in both her lips.
"Do I look like a Derg queen to you? Do you think Drome bestows great riches upon me? And before you ask, I won't be adding saffron, gold, or emeralds either."
The giant lifted his shirt. Beneath was a line of pouches on a long string. He opened one, pinched some of the contents, and held out his hand. Badera waddled forward, and the giant sprinkled a dash into her palm. One brow went way up. The giant grinned.
"What's your name?"
Badera asked.
"Grigor."
"Grigor, would you care to stay for supper?"
Badera asked.
Looking back, she added, "I think we're gonna need more chickens."
The wall of Dol Ren was 20 feet thick, framed with wood and filled with dirt. Grass grew on the top, but the constant traffic from men patrolling the wall had created a worn path that circled the entire Dol. After the evening meal, Wraith had walked the course from one side of the gate to the other, watching the sunset. The height gave him a nice view of the surrounding landscape. The expanse of the forest loomed to the west as a black outline with jagged edges. The eastern side of the Dol was gentle, rolling hills of green. Even in the fading light, he could see the north-south road cutting through the fields. Wraith walked with his Lee Moor tied over one shoulder. The evening wasn't cold. Spring had let go of winter's hand, and was reaching out towards summer. The transition was most evident in the sounds of crickets and the oscillating din of tree frogs, which was even louder on the forest side.
"Travelling will be easier now."
Hearing the ladder's creak, Wraith turned and was surprised to see Persephone climbing up. Trotting over, he extended his hand to help her up. The act was instinctive, but after feeling her fingers, the intimacy of the moment struck him. Hands could be such expressive things. Hers were incredibly warm.
"Malcolm said you were up here. He thought I should let you know I was heading over to speak to Conniger,"
Persephone said as she reached the top. "But honestly, I don't think there will be any trouble." Persephone faced him with hands folded, still wearing her black mourning dress. Her head tilted down as her eyes looked up. That tilt made up his mind.
"Nice up here on a night like this," she said. "I've walked this circle hundreds of times."
"Not many places where you can see so far."
"You haven't been to the top of the tower in Alan Rist, then, have you?"
He shook his head.
"But you've seen it, right? The tower?"
He nodded. "Dol Dareya's near Granford. The tower is hard to miss, but it's not like the Frey give tours." She looked north as if trying to see the great spire.
Did you have family in Dorea?
No, he said. Not anymore. I used to have three brothers and a sister. Heum and Hegel died together in the High Spear Valley, fighting the Gularoons. They're buried there in a mass grave.
Sorry to hear that.
Don't be. I didn't like my brothers. Not even Didan, who was the nicest and closest to me in age. Even he was a bastard. Stabbed me in the hand once because I was playing with his new dagger. Held me down and put the point right into my palm and said, "So you want to know what the blade feels like, do you?" She grimaced as if Didan's stab had just occurred.
"How old were you?"
6, he told her. "So yeah, I had some pretty awful brothers. But my sister and mum were terrific. Lucky for us, my father and brothers weren't around much. When they were gone, we'd stay up late, singing songs and telling stories. Kaylin, she was my sister, had an incredible imagination. Almost every tale had a ghost or dragon and a hero who rescued a beautiful girl. We'd be in the house around the fire, with the winter gales shaking the walls, listening to her go on. She helped us forget how low we were on dung bricks, and how cold the night would be. Kaylin could do that sort of thing with her stories. Take you someplace else. Someplace warm. Someplace wonderful. Best times we had were when everyone else was off to war, and it was just the three of us." Wraith stopped talking and gritted his teeth, feeling his throat tighten. He squeezed his left hand, the one Didan had stabbed. "We tell stories here, too, but most aren't so pleasant. The heroes are usually lost in the forest, and either eaten or sucked away into the spirit world forever. We tell them to keep children out of the forest, but it makes winter nights bleak. I think I would have liked your sister's stories better." Persephone brushed back her hair and looked out at the fading light. "Malcolm says the two of you are leaving in the morning."
"Yeah," Wraith replied. "At least I'm going. Can't speak for Malcolm."
"Why are you leaving?"
Wraith looked to the north again. "I don't think it's safe having the God-Killer here. Well, in any village, really. Best if I find a little out-of-the-way place of my own."
"But I was hoping you'd..."
"Yeah, I remember what you were hoping, but I'm not Koenig material."
"You're a great warrior, and you have tremendous courage."
"No, I'm just a stubborn Doraean, which I guess is another way of saying stupid. You don't want a stupid Koenig."
"I don't think you're stupid. You're brave, kind and decent."
"You don't know me."
"I know you fought for me at the Cascade, and against the wolves. You stood up against Conniger and faced the gods when no one else dared."
"Whose point are you trying to prove?" He smiled. She smiled back and was prettier for it, younger looking.
"Listen," he said. "I sort of made a promise to myself. I come from a family of warriors. All my father and brothers ever did was fight. One battle after another. It's all they knew. So that's what they did. Kill and burn. They were good at it. Good at destroying things. But they died fighting. None of them ever accomplished anything, well, positive. Or lasting. They never built something, or made a difference. I want my life to amount to more than years of bloodshed."
"But being Koenig is just more killing, don't you see? You want me to be like my father. You want me to lead people into battle, to kill and destroy. I want something else."
"What do you mean by else?"
"Better."
"Better?"
Persephone chuckled.
"What could be better than being the leader of our entire race?"
"To live somewhere safe and raise a family."
to teach my sons to do the same. That would be good and lasting.
Wraith allowed himself to look directly into her eyes. He always did this with men. Anything less was disrespectful, even cowardly. But with a woman, the same action felt indecent somehow. Maybe because he enjoyed it. He couldn't hold his gaze and still say what he planned, so he looked back out of the hills.
I was thinking, hoping, you might consider coming with me.
With you?
He kept looking over the wall. I don't see how you can stay. Your chieftain is siding with Hegner, and he'll have to administer justice. If you stay, he'll punish you. What do they do to kill us here?
He didn't wait for her to answer. He wanted to get it all out.
Whatever it is, be hard to do if you're not around. Besides, you're like I am. You don't have a family. Not anymore. You don't even have a home to call your own.
He let his eyes return from their exile and look back into hers.
I've enjoyed your company, and it sounds like you've done a lot of traveling and know your way around. It'd be nice having you along. I'm thinking we can find some place where we could both start over. Her brows were up and her mouth open even before she spoke.
Are you asking me to run away with you?
Her tone sounded just short of laughter.
Wraith's heart sank, and he sucked a breath in through his teeth.
I'll take that as a no. Persephone's eyes weren't so bright now, and Wraith shifted his focus to the grass at their feet.
He felt a burning desire to be anywhere else than where he was. His face was hot, and he felt a prickly heat where leather covered skin.
He took a couple of steps away.
Wait!
She stopped him with a hand on his arm.
I'm sorry. I'm flattered.
I am, but... don't you think I'm a little old for you?
Obviously not, or I wouldn't have asked.
He didn't like the sound of his voice. It came out with a bite. That wasn't the way he wanted to leave things, but...
I should get away before I say something to make this worse.
Instead, he blurted out, Is it because of Nephron?
Persephone looked puzzled.
Nephron? Why are you bringing him up?
He's interested in you, right?
Interested in me? A rune?
She looked at him, amazed.
When he saw you at the gate, he lost concentration. Nearly got him killed.
I guess I could see how you might... She rolled her eyes.
Oh, please. There are lots of stories where gods become infatuated with mortal women.
Looking over her shoulder, she smirked.
They're not gods, remember? Besides, I don't think that's going to be a problem. If anyone is likely to catch one of their eyes, it'll be Moya.
She put a worried hand to her brow and sighed. Now that I think about it, I ought to talk to her about staying away from them.
Wraith drew away again.
Wraith?
She stepped forward, her face pained.
My husband was killed less than a month ago. We were married for 20 years. I loved him. I still love him. Can you understand?
In his head, he told her she wasn't helping. He wanted to explain that loyalty and devotion were virtues he rarely found, and he wanted to be as fortunate as Reglan had been. In his head, he also apologized for intruding on her grief, and for presuming someone like him had a chance with someone like her. He was Duraean, after all. He imagined telling her all these things, but when he finally opened his mouth, all he said was,
Okay.
The word hung there, heavy and sad. Perhaps she didn't want that to be the last word between them because she spoke again.
You're wrong about me not having a family. Padera's like a mother to me, the way she has been to everyone since her children died. Bryn is like my daughter, or at least a niece, because I consider Sarah my sister. Moya is like a troublesome but irresistible cousin, and Gifford... She reached up and wiped her eyes. You see, I do have a family, and they're in trouble. Serious trouble. I can't leave. I'll be able to convince Conagher of my innocence. I've known him for years. She performed a more thorough wiping of her face, then stepped forward and hugged him tightly. I want to thank you for all you've done for me and everyone here. You saved my life more than once. I wish you would stay. You don't have to be the Keening if you don't want. You can still help. You've already helped so much just by being here. And maybe you could build a happy life in Dol Ren. What do you say? She released him and stepped back, hands clasped before her. Wraith didn't feel quite so foolish anymore. He was far from happy, but the hug was nice. He'd never wanted much. Doreans didn't have dreams the way others did. Food and warmth were all they cared about. But until that moment, Wraith's plan was to be alone in the wilderness. But now he saw how lonely, how empty that would be. He found himself nodding. And as for the fray, Persephone looked over her shoulder at their camp near the well. Who knows how long they'll stay? To be honest, they scare me. They scare everyone. Except you. She was wrong. The fray scared him plenty. Why they hadn't killed him, he wasn't sure. The Galantians appeared impressed by the novelty of a rune who refused to give in, a rune who would fight. Leaving before the novelty wore off was the smart thing to do, but the idea of going without her made his stomach sink. Perhaps given some time, I'll be able to convince her to come. Persephone sighed and looked at the lodge. Well, I suppose there's no point in delaying any longer. Best get at it. Be careful in there, he told her. I mean it, Persephone. If you have any problem, yell. Yell real loud, and then get out of the way. I'll do the rest. Thanks, but attacking the chieftain probably isn't the right approach, and I doubt it would help my case.
Works in Dorea. He smiled.
She started back down the ladder and paused. It'll be okay, you'll see. I've known Conagher for years. He was my husband's shield, after all. I just need to explain my side of things. Oh, and you can call me Seth. You've earned that. The Galantians said they'll help us, Persephone declared, standing before the chairs in the center of the lodge's great hall. Delwyn and Tope Highland had come along. The two men stood beside and slightly behind her. Tope's boots were muddy after a day spent turning soil on the ridge. He wasn't known as a fighter, but years working in the high fields had made him strong. Delwyn held his shepherd's staff in one hand, and the big floppy hat Sarah had made in the other. He wasn't a warrior either, but as close to a brother as Persephone had. Both men were eager to get home after a long day's work, but had agreed to come with her.
Help us how?
Conagher's tone was more than skeptical, but shy of sarcastic, a low, smouldering growl of reluctant tolerance. Conagher and Tressa sat in the first and second chairs, wearing stone faces. Maeve and Cryer stood to either side, as was proper for the chieftain's shield and the keeper of ways. The formality was grating. She was being received like a stranger. Worse even, Persephone smelled cooked meat and baked bread, but the food had been cleared before she entered,
Even a stranger would have been invited to dine with them. Persephone refused to look at Hegna, who stood in the back. She also avoided Maeve's and Tressa's eyes, and kept her focus on Conniger.
"If other Frey come to destroy Dal Ren, they'll speak for us. They believe it's possible to prevent what happened in Dorea and Nadak from occurring here."
There were others in the hall, including Riggles, who farmed the fertile southern fields, and Devon, the huntsman who had been Sackett's close friend. All of them had something in common. She didn't know them well, and some, like Cryer and the Stump, she didn't like. There were others, too, new faces that clustered in the shadows behind the first chair. Not one of them greeted this news with a smile.
"Why would they do such a thing?"
Conniger asked.
"Because these Frey oppose what the other Frey are doing. They disobeyed their leaders, and refused to burn Nadak and Dorea, and—"
"And yet Nadak was burned,"
said one of the strangers who stood behind the chairs, a man with a grizzled face and an accusing stare. She didn't understand where all the hostility came from until she noticed the hammer brooch pinned to his shoulder. He was from Nadak.
"True, but they didn't do it," she explained. "They tried to stop it. These nine are renegades. They don't want to hurt us. They can't return to Alenrist, so they're looking for a place to shelter. But if the others do come, these Frey will speak on our behalf, convince their kind to spare us. Don't you see that if—"
"If the Galantians are outlaws, why would anyone listen to them?"
Conniger asked.
"And since they are criminals, won't their presence put us in greater danger? Harboring fugitives will prove to Alenrist that we're troublemakers. Allowing these renegades to stay will make matters worse."
Persephone clapped her hands against her sides.
"If the Frey do intend to burn Dal Ren to the ground and kill every last man, woman, and child, how could matters get worse? Don't we stand a better chance with these Galantians as allies?"
"If is the important word in what you said. What if the Frey have already enacted the full extent of their retribution? If they have no plans on attacking us, we'll give them a reason to change their minds," Conniger said, a stern look on his face.
"Our best option is to appease them," Tressa said. "Maybe if we handed over these outlaws, could we do that? Could we send word to Alenrist and tell them they're here? Wouldn't that prove we're not like Dorea?"
Tressa's eyes widened with excitement.
"We could hand over the Godkiller, too. I'm sure it would impress them. They would see we aren't a problem. They might even reward us."
"According to Nephron, the Galantian's leader, the Frey of Alenrist have been ordered to eliminate all runes. This goes beyond retribution for one Frey's death. They are bent on killing all of us."
"Nephron." Conniger stopped her. "So you're on a first-name basis with this Frey?"
"He told us his name, yes." "He told you, is what you mean," Tressa said. "Why hasn't this Nephron presented himself to Conniger? Why hasn't he come before the chieftain?"
"I don't know. Maybe they're expecting someone from the lodge to come out to speak with them."
"And I'm wondering why these outlaws are so willing to help us."
"Why would they go against their own kind?" Tressa asked. "What's in it for them?"
"I'm not sure.
Which is why you should go talk to them."
Persephone was getting frustrated now.
"I would think you would want to find out such things." "And I think you can't help butting in. You can't accept it's me and not you sitting in the second chair. You forget who rules Dal Ren now."
Tressa's face had turned red. "Tressa," Persephone said in a quiet voice,
"people who lead don't need to remind others who the leader is. All I want is for you to do your duty.
All you want from me? How dare you stand there and demand...
Conniger patted his wife's hand, apparently trying to calm her. I think there is a bigger point being overlooked. He gazed sternly at Persephone. Up until a few days ago, everything was fine. Now two of the doll's most capable hunters are dead, and we have been overrun by not only the famed god-killer, but a contingent of Frey warriors whom you invited in against my orders. The whole thing seems a bit too convenient for my taste.
The others in the lodge were nodding and exchanging knowing looks. Something was going on, had been going on since before she had entered.
While she talked, the men scowled. Persephone had expected to find relief or appreciation, although she could have understood finding concern, worry, or fear. Instead, she saw agreement on the faces of the men gathered in the great hall.
What has Hegner been saying about me?
You don't think I see what you're doing? Conniger accused. If you wanted to rule, you should have made a proper challenge like Holliman did. Oh, but you couldn't, could you? You didn't have anyone here strong enough to act as your champion. So you had to plot and wait while you maneuvered outsiders. Now you have your own personal army of Frey.
Conniger, you've known me since you were a boy, and protected me and my family for a decade. You know me. You can't possibly believe I'd kill or arrange for others to kill Adler and Sackett. You're jumping to conclusions. I know you're in a difficult position, and it's Hegner's word against mine. But look at the sources. I'm a respected chieftain's widow who helped lead this clan through the Great Famine and the Long Winter, whereas Hegner's claim to fame was when he stole Whedon's prized calf. Who deserves your trust?
I didn't steal no calf, Hegner shouted.
You've also said you didn't take a jug of Bergen's beer, but you were caught with it.
Yeah, well, okay, I took the beer, but I didn't steal no calf.
There, Persephone said. This is who you're listening to. Do you really think I've been having secret meetings in the forest? You know damn well I haven't set foot in the forest in all the years you've guarded me and my family. And except that one time, I haven't left Sarah's house since Reglan's death. I was gone for one day. Just one. As for the Frey, they aren't my personal anything. But if they were, why would I come here and try to convince you to step up and go see them?
The only reason I've talked to Nephron at all is because no one else was. So what did you tell this Nephron? Conniger asked, folding his arms over his chest.
I told him he had permission to speak on behalf of Dol Ren if more Frey arrive.
This brought a wide smile to Tressa's face and made Conniger's head nod along with the rest. They all seemed pleased, with the exception of Hegner, who slunk back into the shadows.
You didn't think you should ask your chieftain before making alliances?
Cryer asked.
Until then, he had leaned against a winter post, but at that moment he took a step toward her.
Cryer was an ugly man who'd first come to Persephone's attention for beating Gifford. The bully often taunted and threw rotten vegetables at the potter. The matter had come before Reglan, and Cryer defended himself by saying the cripple had attacked him with his crutch, but witnesses said Gifford had simply fallen on Cryer after tripping.
Gifford is cursed by the gods. Having him around invites bad luck,
Cryer often said. Although no one was ever accused, someone had tried to set fire to Gifford's house, and it was no secret whom most suspected. Tope, who was no friend of Cryer, straightened up and spit in his direction.
You have a problem, Tope? Cryer asked.
Yeah, Tope replied. You're too far away. Persephone put a hand on the farmer's sleeve, trying to calm him. Then said to Conniger,
Would you have said differently? Would you have refused their help and tried to keep them out of Dalaran?
That's not the point,
Tressa nearly shouted, and slammed her hand down on the arm of the chair.
You had no right. Reglan is dead, dead and buried. You aren't in charge anymore.
Enough.
Conniger raised his hands.
I'm the chieftain of this clan, and I need time to figure this out. One thing I do know, the Galantians represent a threat. Maybe they are in league with Persephone, or maybe their kind will attack us because we are providing shelter. Either way, we would be safer if they weren't here. So this is my decree.
He looked directly at her.
Persephone, you'll go out there and tell the Frey you had no authority to speak on behalf of Clan Wren. Then you'll inform them we don't want their help and tell them to leave. As for this matter between you and Hegner, I'll decide that later when I can address it properly.
Persephone looked at Delwyn and Tope. The two stood rigid, their eyes shifting nervously.
You have a problem with that? Conniger asked.
Persephone nodded. Yes. Yes, I do. I did what I thought was best to save this doll. It was not my intention to challenge your authority, but rather to encourage you to exercise it. You're the great chieftain, so act like it. If you want the Frey to leave, you go out there and tell them yourself, and I'll go back to living off the kindness of friends. Maybe I'll start knitting a shawl. I think I'll need one come winter. If you haven't killed us all before then, that is.
Persephone turned and walked away so abruptly that Delwyn and Tope were momentarily left behind. As she left, she heard Tressa say,
See, what did I tell you?
Chapter 13 The Bones. Suri had a wolf named Mina. They were the best of friends and roamed the forest together. She had tattoos, was always filthy, afraid of nothing, and could do magic. From the first time I met her, I wanted to be Suri. I still do. The Book of Brynn. The bones were excellent for a chicken. Suri would have preferred a crow, or, better yet, a raven. Gods frequently chose them to be messengers, and spirits often inhabited their bodies. Not that Suri would dare kill one to get at its bones. The divine rarely appreciated the murder of a faithful servant. And, of course, there was always the risk of actually wringing the neck of a spirit in bird form, and that was just a bad day for everyone involved. The chicken bones would work even if the connection through the veil would be hazy and intermittent. At least she wouldn't fear offending anyone. No god, goddess, or spirit would ever inhabit or employ a chicken. Suri plans to call on Mera. She didn't know exactly what she was looking for, but Mera, the goddess of wisdom, was the patron of Persephone's home, and so Suri figured Mera would be the best overall choice. Suri was outside the palisade on the western side of the Dal, the highest point she could find. Mina lay quietly on the hill, a few feet away, giving her space. The wolf was considerate that way. The mystic built her little fire and waited for the sun to descend. It was best to begin a reading at dusk, when the doors between the worlds were open the widest. They wouldn't remain open long. While waiting, she divided the bones into groups. Those taken from the right side of the chicken referred to the us, the ones on whose behalf she performed the reading. Bones from the left represented the others, those in opposition. As the sun dipped behind the distant trees, Suri dropped the two sets of bones into the flames.
She waited as the black line of forest trees swallowed up the giant orange ball. She didn't count or use any physical measurements. Suri was an instinctive augur. She performed her rituals by feel. Tura had taught Suri everything the old mystic had known, but she admitted no one could teach interpretation. You were either born with the talent or not. Suri had the gift. Tura had spotted it right away. The old mystic told Suri how she had called songbirds as a toddler. After placing the child in a clearing of daisies, violets and bluebells, Tura would hide in the nearby forest eaves. Before long, Suri would be surrounded by a flock of birds, a multicolored gathering of unrelated songsters, goldfinches, red-winged blackbirds, blue jays, magpies, yellow and black-throated warblers, bay wrens, robins, mockingbirds, and song sparrows. Suri would sit among them, delighting in their symphony. Gathering birds wasn't her only talent. She also talked to fire spirits, knew when it would rain, and could predict the arrival of the first hard frost. Suri had the gift, but Tura gave her the tools to use it. As the sky shifted hue from orange to purple, Suri felt the moment and doused the fire. Fire spirits hated water. All the children of the fire god Uta did. This one was no different, and it hissed at her. "Sorry," she told it, and wished she knew its name. She wasn't even certain all spirits had names. The most important ones did. Wogan, the spirit of the Crescent Forest, for example, and Fribblebibble, the spirit of the High Stream, whose name she loved saying. The little fire spirits were like the rock and breeze spirits, too many to keep track of. She wondered if Alan bothered to name them all. Gathering the bones, Suri laid them on a woven mat and began looking for the fireborn cracks and tiny holes. The way Tura had explained it, searching for truth in bones was a lot like guessing a person's intent from the tone of his or her voice. In this case, it would be the voice of Mera, and the language was that of the divine. As such, much was left to interpretation. Still, Suri had a knack for divination that wasn't restricted to just reading bones. Tura had marveled at Suri's ability to find her way in the forest. Initially, the older mystic attributed this skill to an excellent memory, but tossed that idea aside when Suri demonstrated the ability to find places she hadn't been to before. After more than 50 years in the Crescent, Tura had discovered two of the underground rooms, the ones Malcolm had called Durg Rolls. Suri found the other three in a week. But communing with fire spirits is where Suri excelled the most. By the age of 8, her game of talking to fires and making the flames dance and change color had grown into something more. While watching Tura struggle to light kindling by spinning a stick with a bow, Suri ignited her own pile of wood with a few words.
"How did you do that?" Tura had asked.
Suri shrugged.
"I asked the fire spirit to come, and it did. Isn't that right?"
Tura nodded, but Suri had seen the confusion in the old woman's face, along with apprehension, and maybe even a little fear. Tura began talking about Malkins after that, and mentioned how Suri might have come from the land of Crimbles. Suri stared at the bones, reading them as best she could in the fading light. That was always a problem with sunset readings. Such things needed the light of day to decipher, and it faded so fast. As the sun set and the night took hold of the world, Suri read a number of things. They weren't the answers she was looking for. Nothing about the men and why they had attacked. But what she saw was even more important.
Suri finished studying the patterns on the right leg. The holes were close together and near the top, indicating the forecast would be impending rather than concerning some distant future. Looking at the cracks, she saw there were two lines, which suggested two separate tales. First and foremost, the chicken was flooded with bad omens, in the same overwhelming manner that Suri had seen just before coming to Persephone. Little had changed on that score. Looking deeper, searching for specifics, she saw that all the bones agreed that the full moon would be the time of the reckoning, the pivotal moment. The bones didn't say how because the bones didn't know, most likely because she was reading a chicken. They only showed a convergence of powers that, depending on the outcome, would change the world. Three of the bones told of a terrible danger to both the us and the them. One of the bones fascinated Suri because it suggested that a great secret was hidden in the forest and guarded by a bear. That bone also said this secret would play a significant role in the conflict to come. But it was the last bone that shocked her more than any other. The largest and clearest, only its tip had been marred by the fire. This bone declared that a monster was coming to Dol Ren to kill them all. Suri cursed the fading light as she stared at the cracks and smudges. She would have guessed the monster referred to the fray, but no. The marks indicated a single creature rather than a host of enemies. And the markings were so clear that Suri knew the monster's name. More came after that, but was lost to charring. It didn't matter. Suri had all the hints she needed. "Grin," she said aloud. A moment later, a bear roared in the distance, startling a flock of dark birds. They flew away toward the setting sun, toward the west. Mina's head came up, her eyes peering at the forest. She whispered to Mina, "That's not good." Chapter 14. Into the West. So many of our words originally came from either the Derg or the Frey. The Frey word for primitive being rune, it became their word for humans. Rulin then means land of rune. Avrilin means land of green. And Dal was the Frey word for wall. The suffix yid in Frey translates to new, which is why on the map I have named this region Renyid, the Book of Brin. Because of its name, Arion expected the frontier of Avrilin to be green. But for the last several days, all she'd seen was brown. Brown rocks, brown grass, brown mud. Even the trees were dingy. She'd also been disappointed by the lack of fields. Arion had seen paintings of open valleys, large expanses of flat land or rolling hills that granted visions of massive skies and wondrous sunsets. Instead, since crossing the Nidwalden, she had walked through an endless tunnel of forests. And the vast woodlands known as the Harwood weren't anything like the ancient groves of Erevan. They didn't invite guests to wander in dappled shade. Instead, dense thickets shunned the light and barred passage with thorny brambles. Forests here were wild, hostile things, and she imagined secrets cloaked in moss, leaf, and needle. She followed Thyam, who rode on a cream-colored horse. Grendel had offered to supply her with a guide, but she had declined. It wasn't due to any concern about him harming or spying on her. She simply didn't want to spend several days of isolation with one of Grendel's toadies. Still, she recognized the need for a guide. To her surprise, Arion learned that no living Merilith, aside from the Fane, had set foot outside of Erevan. That forced her to pick a guide from one of the other tribes, which widened the choices, but not by much. Few Frey, besides the Instaria, had ever crossed the Nidwalden River, and none of them could be found in Estremnadon. Eventually, she narrowed the choices to six. They included an Elowin architect who had once been employed by the Instaria to do some repair work on the northernmost fortress of Ervenon, after it had suffered an attack from a band of giants. She'd asked three times about the giant attack to be certain she'd heard correctly. She had. There was also a trio of Nilead builders, the same ones the Elowin had brought with her to do the actual repairs. Another possibility was an Ascendwar hunter, who had served for several hundred years at each of the four Avrilin frontier outposts, but he was ill when Arion visited. And then there was Thyam, an Umalin who was charged by the tribe of Ferrol's faithful to spend the warm months ministering to the outer reaches. Arion chose Thyam because she felt comfortable with one of Ferrol's faithful, having grown up among that tribe. After 2,000 years, Arion recognized almost everyone living in Estremnadon, and Thyam was no different. Still, he had been just a face and a name, and although she'd probably met him before, she couldn't recall any conversations. Thyam was in the process of preparing for his yearly trip west when she explained about the Fane sending her to Alon Rist, and she asked if he would act as her escort to the frontier. He replied with a stiff smile and a dutiful nod, then introduced her to the horse she would ride. Arion had never ridden a horse. Few sane Frey had. The skittish animals were known to bolt or throw their riders. Ferrol had blessed the Frey with 3,000 years of life, and given that falls often resulted in permanent injury or death, the idea of getting on the back of even the most docile animal was reason for concern. "Can't we walk?" she had asked when meeting the horse for the first time.
"It's nearly 100 miles over rough terrain to Alon Rist,"
Thyam replied.
"And forgive me, Your Eminence, but you don't look like you do much hiking."
She conceded, accepting the logic that there was little point in obtaining a greened field guide's services if she didn't take his advice. And that's how Arion came to be precariously perched on the back of an extremely tall white horse named Narasper, when she and her guide reached the edge of the Harwood. The long tunnel of trees ended, and Arion beheld a wondrous sight. Leaving the forest, she discovered they were at a great height, on a ridge that afforded a breathtaking view. Having lived her entire life under Erevan's canopy, Arion was amazed.
"So this is the sky."
The entirety of it was so broad and deep, it appeared endless. There were inexplicable white wisps floating above them, and a brilliant light. Previously, she'd experienced the sun only filtered through layers of leaves and needles. Looking straight out, Arion saw her first horizon. She could see for forever. Hills rose and fell in blue ridges. Even more impressive was the monstrous mountain that towered over them. Cone-shaped, it appeared to challenge the vast blue of the sky for dominance, its peak a brilliant white. From it flowed a river, which snaked below them, glistening silver. But not even the mountain could rival the awe-inspiring sight of the sky. Thyam waited patiently, his horse's tail swishing. The Umalin were a patient lot, but he also must have known the effect of that bend in the road. She imagined that everyone he travelled with paused in that exact spot.
"It's beautiful," she said.
From here on, you'll need to travel with your hood up to guard against the sun. Cover your skin,